Welcome to our Holden Village podcast. For over 50 years now, Holden Village has traveled a rich history of faith that has transformed a copper mining town into a vibrant place of education, programming, and worship. Holden has sought to welcome all who seek contemplation and community in the remote wilderness of the beautiful Cascade Mountains. We continue to invite people of all ages to come alongside our rhythms, which inspire and equip travelers for a sustainable life of faith outside the village. And we continue to listen and reflect on our story and history and seek to discover our place in God's creative mission in our world. Our podcasts are a way of sharing our conversations with our teaching faculty around reformation, the reforming of our relationships with the earth, with each other, and with the divine. Let's tune in and join the conversation.
So my name is Katie Sherrar, and I live in Tucson, Arizona. And I got to Holden a few days ago, about, 5 days ago or so, to teach a class on borders, resistance, and sanctuary. I came to, be familiar with this topic just due to a long history of work and study there. I got to El Paso and Ciudad Juarez in Texas and Chihuahua when I was about 20 or 21 years old in 2003. And I arrived there to, as a college student, to just like look at how issues of injustice and unequal access were playing out in the country of which I was a citizen. Rather than studying abroad in a more traditional context, I wanted to kind of interrogate my own country. And I actually pretty much hated the border the entire time I was there because it's a very difficult place in a way because it really calls upon you to name and confront your own privilege and then have to live with that anyway because it's not like just by being there I'm going to all of a sudden like lose my nationality or lose my whiteness or lose my formal education. And so I just had to wrestle with those questions in a very real way and on a daily basis, and it wasn't a particularly comfortable process. But I think like asking those questions also made me feel like deeply engaged and deeply alive. And there was something also about the border that for all of the difficulties that it presented also inspired a lot of hope in me just because of the kind of levels of collaboration and commingling that existed that doesn't get quite as widely reported on as the hopelessness. And so I stayed right after I graduated from college. I returned to the border to work at a shelter for undocumented immigrants in El Paso who just made it across the boundary. And they got to that shelter in a whole lot of different ways. Sometimes the Border Patrol would drop them off, and sometimes they would, you know, just kind of find it through word of mouth, and sometimes local churches would bring them there. And that was a really powerful and impactful way for me to live because it reminded me of how to live justly and in solidarity with neighbors who looked nothing like me and who had much different backgrounds than I did. And then kind of continued that work, kept on with study through graduate school in Tucson, Arizona, and then taught college for about 6 years, focused on borders and migration issues, so got a very good sense of how things were playing out theoretically and kind of arguments for and against like open borders or against particular policy reforms. But after having been there for a certain number of years, I mean, I guess I left for a lot of different reasons, but one was also just that I felt like I was increasingly teaching on things that existed for me largely in the abstract and less so in the concrete. And so from that, I got to my current position, which is at it's a place called the Kino Border Initiative, which does educational programs and advocacy and also direct humanitarian aid to people who have just been deported and or who are about to cross. So there's a lot of people who, Mexicans, who get deported after they've either, you know, just attempted to cross the desert and it hasn't worked out, or after they've been living for years, decades even, in various parts of the U.S. And so we see them from all over, a lot from, of course, Tucson and Phoenix area, a lot from Salt Lake City and Las Vegas. There's been a lot, actually, recently from Minneapolis and then also Salem, Oregon, and then also this area. There's a lot who have been living in Yakima and Spokane. And so they will just have been picked up by ICE and then sent to the Comedor. So this week in class, we've just kind of been covering some of what the borderlands look like what are the various steps in like people's journeys, like why are they coming north to begin with, what are they fleeing, how do people cross the line and what encounters do they have once they cross? Like, who's guiding them? What happens if they get picked up by Border Patrol? What happens if they don't? How many do? How many don't? What are detention center conditions like? What happens when people get deported? What should our response be? And then we'll be moving also into just kind of the response by people with a lot of different commitments and passions and courage. And yeah, it's a very diverse and very engaged group. And the ideas that people have come up with about how we might respond as people of faith and as people who are kind of in this, in Holden Village at this moment in time, has been really inspiring to me. The first time I heard of Holden Village was when I was young and in El Paso, 22 or so. And there was someone who came through on the Border Servant Corps, which is, I believe, run through a Lutheran church out of Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I was giving her a tour of Annunciation House where I was working. And she mentioned to me that she'd just come from Holden Village, where she'd spent a formative year as a 21-year-old or so. And I, yeah, filed it away. And then years later, I encountered it again when I was living in Guatemala, actually. And then someone that I was doing accompaniment with had also just spent a year here. So I, again, put it on my bucket list to return to. And I came up here on a spring break in March of, must have been 2013 or 14. Spent 10 days or so, and then did a short talk while I was here on border issues, and then always had in mind to come back as for a summer and work on the teaching faculty. That's why I'm here now. I think a lot of people kind of have this idea that Mexico is the place where a lot of people flee from, and there's a lot of poverty and violence there, and that's certainly true. There's definitely, you know, the minimum wage in Mexico is like less than $5 a day. And the gangs are very prevalent in, you know, a lot of the border states and in a few particular states like Guerrero and Oaxaca. But by and large, it's a much wealthier country than the Central American countries. And Mexico and the U.S. have collaborated to kind of stop migration on the Mexican southern border. And so there's a lot of checkpoints that have developed in Mexico to keep Central Americans out in tandem with the U.S. government. So to be Central American in Mexico is kind of similar to being an undocumented immigrant in the U.S. And so in that way, to like give hospitality to Central Americans in Mexico is kind of like providing sanctuary, but it's different for me just because I'm not a Mexican citizen. And so, yeah, I'm not particularly, I mean, I show up there, I suppose, but it's not my conscious decision to challenge the laws of Mexico, although I suppose in a way that's what we're doing. There's a variety of ways that people will cross into the U.S. if they don't have papers. And people will often say, like, well, why don't they come legally? And one, it's just a very costly process, and people don't have access to that kind of money. And two, we're currently processing the applications for, like, family members of U.S. citizens and residents from, like, 1995. So the wait is about 23 years if current trends continue, which isn't particularly reasonable for most people. And so that's why people cross without authorization, is because there's no real legal avenues. Like, not only if you could pay the fees and if you had that amount of time to wait, that would essentially be your only way in legally, or to be, you know, like a Carlos Slim, or to be another very wealthy person in Mexico who could invest in the U.S. or pay for college education there or whatever. So, yeah, people will either jump over the wall, which is in all of the major urban areas along the borders, like San Diego or El Paso or even Nogales, where I work, there's a big wall. So they'll jump over that, and it's less dangerous, but also there's a higher risk of getting caught. They'll kind of be smuggled through in cars. That's also less dangerous in certain ways. But then if you get caught, there's usually a stiffer legal penalty. And it's also, yeah, much more expensive. And then the most common way is to walk through the desert. So to avoid the wall, to avoid the checkpoints, because the walls taper off in rural areas. And that's just a really difficult and arduous journey because it's really remote, really hot right now, not a lot of water, if any. A high likelihood of getting lost or left behind by your group. So if you know, if you're, for instance, a woman, or if you're older, or if you get blisters, if you twist your ankle, the group generally won't wait for you. And so you then have to make your way alone. And yeah, it's not that much more remote than Holden is. Like, it's a little bit less so, but I mean, it's fairly comparable in a lot of ways to how far out you are from, you know, a town or another habitation. So it's been estimated that about 7,000 people have died in the U.S.-Mexico border since 1994, when the walls started going up. So, yeah, then if you are caught by Border Patrol, you're often sent to a detention to serve out your sentence. Sometimes you're deported back with a criminal charge, but often if you have any kind of previous record in the U.S., then you'll have to serve a detention sentence. And most of those are in for-profit detention facilities. About 62%, I think, of immigration detention is privately owned, and it costs taxpayers about $150 per person per day to house people in a private detention facility versus $98 in a publicly owned one, and about $10 or so for alternatives to detention, which would be like ankle monitors or community supervision to make sure that people go to their court dates. And then as far as deportation, you know, it's happening to people who, you know, both have just crossed the desert, people who have been in the U.S. for a long time. So, you know, family separation was in the news a lot, like last month and 2 months ago, when people who arrived to the border were getting separated from their families. And that was certainly like an awful, awful thing. But it's been happening for a really long time, just in different ways where, you know, there's a lot of family members, or a lot of families who live in the U.S. And if one person is undocumented, then, and they get deported, then their citizen children will remain in the U.S., or their non-citizen children or whatever, but then the families are separated in that way too, and there's no particularly easy way to reunify them except for having the kids come and join the parent in Mexico. And very often the reason they left Mexico or Central America was because of poverty and violence and not great access to education. And so it's a very difficult decision for parents to make, like whether it's better to have families together in a country that's often very difficult to live in, or if they should be separate and like allow their kids to kind of continue to have access to more stability and more safety and better education in the U.S.
Thanks for joining us for another Holden Village podcast. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.